This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. According to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, the Metro Orlando area is the worst in the United States for housing affordability for low income families. But there is help available for renters struggling to get by and for people trying to buy a home. Jody Pena Castaldi is the program manager for the Housing Counseling Unit for Community Legal Services of Mid Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Orlando, as you know, is not a good place to be looking for affordable housing if you're at the lower end of the income spectrum. In fact, according to a recent report, this is of the big metros in the United States, the Orlando area, the greater Orlando area, is the worst place to be trying to find an affordable place to live. What are you seeing as far as the clients that you deal with and their kinds of needs and the challenges they're facing?
So Orlando itself has been priced out of the market, I would say, for the last 18 months, if not longer. But it's expanding. So we're talking, it's going out counties, almost to Volusia County, I would say to Volusia County. What's happening is that the market, the homes that are being put on the market are selling so fast that it's driving up the prices. And so those same houses that maybe were lost to foreclosure back in 04, 05, all the way through, you know, as recently as 2 years ago, they are now way out of range for anybody making probably below 120% of the area median income.
And you're talking about rental.
I'm talking about both, homeownership and rental, because of the housing crisis. I'm from Deltona, so I'm going to give you an example of Deltona area. The houses that for rent there 5 years ago were probably $900 for a 3-2. Easily, it's $1,400 for a 3-2 now. And that's why people are housing poor right now. They're using more than 50% of their income to pay for housing because you have to have a roof over your head so that you can go to school, get a job, all of those things that come with housing. The foreclosure crisis was part of that problem because all of those people who lost homes in foreclosure now had to have a place to rent. They can't own again right now. So where are they going to go? And while their payments, their mortgages were more affordable, now they're stuck with paying $500, $700 more a month and making that work so that they have a roof over their heads. So usually what happens when those types of rentals come up is that people, you know, health starts falling by the wayside. You can't afford your prescriptions. You're not paying your health care. You're not buying healthy food. So everything kind of snowballs. So I think affordable housing is like the epicenter of all other things that happen to people. You know, good things, bad things happen to good people. And the housing market itself right now is that.
How long have you been doing this work for personally?
Since 1990, I've been a housing counselor. So I started in Michigan until 97. I moved here to Florida, and it's what I do, helping people either maintain their housing or find housing and making sure that it's affordable. I always tell people, you want to own a house. You don't want your house to own you. And it's the same with renting. You don't want to pay too much for rent. You want to be able to live. Why work as hard as you do if all your money is going to go towards rent or a mortgage payment?
And it sounds from that little snapshot you gave me of Deltona in the last couple of years, things have gotten a lot harder for folks at the lower end of the income spectrum.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. There is assistance out there for rental assistance. You got your public housing, your Section 8, but those all have waiting lists. And right now, the waiting lists are closed. So just to get on a waiting list, you have to wait for the waiting list to open, and then you're going to sit on a waiting list for 2 to 4 years until they pull your name. You know, I don't know what you do in the meantime.
So where does Community Legal Services of Mid-Florida come in, and what kind of help can you give people?
So Community Legal Services of Mid-Florida, we are a full-service law firm. So we provide civil legal aid for zero to low-income residents of Central Florida. So we cover 12 counties, pretty much Central Florida from coast to coast. We are a HUD-approved housing counseling agency, so we have housing counselors on staff. That's my unit. And we provide non-legal credit and budget. We help people determine how much house they can afford, whether it be to purchase or to rent. And then we provide one-on-one counseling and education. So we teach classes. We review credit reports, all of those things to help people make better choices and hopefully to have changed behaviors in the long run. Community Legal Services, as a provider of civil legal aid, we have a housing unit that can provide advice if somebody is facing foreclosure, if somebody is facing eviction, to better understand what their lease is and what their responsibilities are. We also can assist with helping file answers. So if they are fighting an eviction or they're fighting a foreclosure, our attorneys can help them file those answers. And then if the case is something along our priorities, which housing is, then it might warrant representation depending on how far the case needs to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about helping people make better choices through education and just making them aware of what they can do to budget and what sort of options there are. But it sounds like there isn't a great range of choice. So that must be a bit frustrating for you.
It's incredibly frustrating. And we are seeing more and more people who are doubling up. People who, you know, I never thought, I don't have a roommate now, but I never thought that I would have a roommate in my 30s or even into your 40s. And we're finding more and more people coming in to take a home buyer education workshop who are actually looking to purchase homes with their best friend or because they can't afford it on their own. Or they're living together already in a rental situation because they can't afford to rent an apartment. There was a study that came out from the National Low Income Housing Coalition. It's called the 2018 Out of Reach Report, and it's all about housing. So in Florida, the average two-bedroom rent is $1,118 a month, and that's for a two-bedroom apartment. So for affordable housing standards, your rent should not be more than 30% of your gross monthly income, and that includes rent and your utilities. So somebody would have to make a little over $3,700 a month to afford a two-bedroom apartment in Florida. And with our minimum wage the way it is, that would be 2.5 full-time jobs.
Which is probably what you're seeing, right?
Right, right. It's exactly what we're seeing. We are seeing folks who are being approved for mortgages or being approved for rentals and not being able to find anything in the price range that they're approved for.
Mm-hmm.
With rentals, you know, they can still go over what they're approved for, but then they don't have any money for anything else. So other things happen. You know, they can't keep up their car payment. So then they have trouble getting to and from work. It's just everything just snowballs.
Mm-hmm. So what do you tell people who come looking for help?
We tell them to be persistent and to not give up.
And this is folks who are looking to find affordable housing, whether it be waiting to get on one of these waiting lists for the low-income housing that's out there or
right.
Looking around for something that might better suit their needs?
Correct. So we do a lot of referring to, you know, city and counties have down payment assistance programs that may be able to help them get into home ownership. The problem is that we're getting people approved for those programs and approved for mortgages, but what they're not getting is then they're not finding houses in their price range. I have a client right now who's looking for a home for $121,000 in Deltona, and that's not going to happen. And if it does happen, it's not going to be anything that's habitable. I sit on the Affordable Housing Board for the city of Deltona, and those are things that we talk about every month at our meetings, is what can Deltona do as a city to try to make things more affordable for folks, not just for the folks who are trying to move here, but for the people who currently live there and call Deltona their home. What can we do?
And what are some of the answers you've come up with?
Well, unfortunately, we tend to hit a lot of walls. It's, you know, even with affordable housing, it's that whole not in my backyard. People don't want a low-income tax credit property going up in their, you know, multifamily units going up. And not everybody's that way, but you run into that. So then the fight gets bigger and longer, and there's more red tape. So what we tell people is that, you know, all you can do is take care of business. You have to continue to keep a roof over your head. We do suggest that, you know, if they have to double up, make sure that you protect yourselves. You know, everybody's name should be on everything. You know, all those things that we can provide in an educational workshop. And that's one of the beauty things about community legal services is not only do we provide legal advice, but our attorneys go out and educate all the time as well, providing workshops on various areas of law so that folks can make better choices because they'll have the knowledge up front.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Jody Pena Castaldi. She's the program manager of the Housing Counseling Unit for Community Legal Services of Mid-Florida. Jody, are people beating down your door looking for answers?
It varies. We have more interest right now in housing in general, whether it be rental counseling. We provide rental counseling, so helping people understand how to do a search, where to find the affordable rentals, and how much they can afford. But people are getting frustrated, and that frustration leads to you know, people just making poor choices, and then we see them, unfortunately, because now they're being evicted, or maybe they got a house that they couldn't afford, or they did a land contract and nobody was reviewing anything with them. So we see a lot of poor choices right now. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it's kind of what we've come to.
You talked before about the fact that you have folks on your team helping people who are dealing with or facing eviction and foreclosure. Has demand for that particular part of the service that you provide gone up in recent years?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. The foreclosure crisis itself, I mean, people always say that we're over it, and we still get phone calls every day on foreclosure. It's just the forgotten people that we're seeing now. We don't have that big unemployment issue right now. So, right, these folks who are fighting foreclosure now, it's just because they hung on as long as they could, and now they've got nothing left. Maybe they used their retirement, whatever it was, to continue making payments, but now they're facing foreclosure, and they're soon to be homeless. And then even the homeless shelters are full. So what do you do? And I don't have the answer. And every day we come to work and hope that we find an answer. But in the meantime, what we keep doing is just helping who we can help and educating who we can educate and hoping that other people will share the information and that an answer will come soon.
This is a big problem, and it's going to take some big solutions. I mean, obviously, now things aren't really working the way you'd like to see them work. What do you think has to happen to solve this problem?
I think the folks in power, the advocates, need to step up and make sure that their voices are being heard. Make sure that our city leaders, our county leaders, our state, you know, even up to the national level, that everybody understands that affordable housing is a crisis, the lack of affordable housing. And you know, nothing gets fixed overnight because we didn't run into this problem overnight. So it's baby steps. We're all in it together. So if that means just changing some local laws to maybe I know I read, and I don't remember what city it was. It was somewhere out east where they now have rent control across the board in their city. If not rent control, then maybe a subsidized rental program where, you know, you've got your Section 8 programs and your public housing programs, and those programs have been full for decades. So then how do we help the people that are kind of caught in between, the folks who weren't on the waiting list and who aren't currently given that that assistance but can't afford just your traditional rent? So how do we help them? And I don't know. Is it new programs? Do we create new programs? Do we build? You know, I know that we hope to incentivize developers to come in and build more affordable housing. But then how do you maintain them? How do you keep them affordable? A lot of your low-income tax credits only have to remain affordable for so many years. And then sometimes those programs even buy out those tax credits so they can raise their rents. Mm-hmm. So then how do you maintain that? How do you stop that from happening? I'm not sure what the answer is. I just know that the fight's not over and we just have to show up every day for it. Everything comes back to affordable housing. If we can't provide it and it's not made available, then we're going to continue to see either an influx of people moving from place to place where they might be able to secure some affordable housing. But then your workforce is leaving. You know, businesses are going to be affected because people aren't spending money in those businesses anymore because now they've left. So it all ties together.
If people need help from your folks right now, what do they do?
Well, they can call our helpline, and that's for legal advice. So Community Legal Services does have a helpline, and it's manned by attorneys who will qualify you for services and then provide the advice and then a referral if necessary. So the helpline number is 1-800-405-1417, and that's open Monday through Friday. And then if you're looking for housing counseling and maybe you want to take one of our first-time homebuyer classes or you want to get some financial counseling, you can go to our website, which is clsmf.org, and you can look at the calendar, and it'll tell you when the next classes are coming up, or you can call 386-222-0307, and that's to register for either counseling or a class.
Well, Jody Pena-Castaldi is Program Manager of the Housing Counseling Unit for Community Legal Services of Mid-Florida. Jody, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Still to come, breaking down the barriers to higher education for prisoners. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Stetson University Professor of World Languages and Cultures, Pamela Kappas-Toro, wants to make sure that prison is no barrier to education. With a grant from the Laughing Gull Foundation, she and a group of educators at Stetson launched a college education course for inmates at Tomoka Correctional Institution. The students have access to a computer lab, and the project they're working on now includes researching the names of people who are enslaved at the Spring Garden Plantation. From the Education Desk this week, Pamela Kappas-Toro joins me for a conversation about increasing access to higher education for the incarcerated. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Matthew, for having us here.
So we spoke to you last year, and at that stage, you were just getting started on the program with the grant, right? You were rolling this out. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that program has gone in the last year or so.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So a lot of very wonderful updates. Thanks to the Laughing Gull Foundation, now we are offering our second college credit course, mm-hmm. Approaches to World Cultures, which I'm teaching. We have now more than 20 contact hours of Stetson professors going to the prison, offering classes, workshops, and resource room hours. We also have a running computer lab that, thanks to Professor Josh Eckrott, he helped install, designing the computer lab. So this is wonderful that students are now working on the research papers on the computer lab. Students have been working for a year on the project of the slavery and Indian removal in East Florida. And they're going to have their first scholarly publication coming next week in Process, which is the blog for the Journal of American History. Hmm. Dr. Yelena Petrovic, which is one of our co-directors, is serving on the planning committee for the upcoming National Conference of Higher Education in Prison to be held in St. Louis. So many, many wonderful things that are happening thanks to the support of the Laughing Gull Foundation.
Did you expect that you would be in this position like a year ago? Because that's a lot. Like, did you envision all this, or has it gone better than you thought?
It's going better, to be honest with you, because that was part of the goals that we proposed for the Laughing Gull Foundation. But the way that everything is running, the support that we have received from the Department of Corrections has been also very positive. So mm-hmm. There are many, many things going on, and we're very happy that that things are getting even better than we imagined, thanks to Laughing Gull Foundation.
So tell me more about the scholarly publication that the students are working on. What's that about?
Yeah, so they are exploring new narratives about this process of slavery and Indian removal, digging into many archives that haven't been previously explored. And they're working with Dr. Eisen, which is also the co-director of the Community Education Project. Mm-hmm. But really, what's happening during the resource room hours is that the students are transcribing a lot of these archival documents that they're finding. They're working in different clusters, so different students have different topics that they're exploring within this very large project. Mm-hmm. And yes, like I mentioned before, now they are publishing their first scholarly publication, but with the possibility of keep publishing.
Wow.
So it is an ongoing project, and it's not stopping here. This is just the beginning of their research.
As far as the research goes, typically when you're researching, you can go to libraries and you can look at the mm-hmm. source material, right?
Yes.
These folks, your students, because they're prisoners, they can't do that. So how do you have them work on the research? Like, do you bring the materials to them?
So thanks to Professor Josh Eckroth in the library system of Stetson, we have an internal JSTOR kind of like a programming style. However, they can access the abstracts of many articles, but mm-hmm. they don't have access to the articles because we don't have internet in the prison.
Right.
So the secondary documents, they can find information in the database of the computer lab that we have at Tomoka. But like I mentioned before, all the primary sources, that's Dr. Eisen that works outside. He digs in the many archives and then he prints, he brings in. So it's a lot of work, mm-hmm. but it's very rewarding to see during the resource room hours students just working on the research.
Is there a substitute, though, for actually going and doing the hands-on research yourself? Like, Would there be a way down the track to give the students that opportunity?
Unfortunately, at this point, there is no opportunity. However, Dr. Eisen has visited the Spring Garden Plantation, so he has taken pictures, videos of the current exhibit of the place. Mm-hmm. And actually, that was the first inspiration for the students to start the project, because there is one sign at the plantation that says that the names of the people have been longer forgotten. Mm-hmm. And up to date, they have found more than 200 names of the people that were enslaved in that plantation. So they are, through the history project, rearticulating the histories of these people that the state park had claimed, right, that they have been forgotten.
Wow. So they're uncovering these names, and these have been lost to history for mm-hmm. so many years, and now they're out there again.
That's correct.
That must be pretty satisfying for the students and for you as well, I'm sure.
Yes, it's for everyone. And one of the wonderful things is that some of these local histories are also embedded in the courses that are currently offered at the DeLand campus at Stetson. So the incarcerated students are helping the DeLand students to have a more complete narrative, right, of the past. Mm-hmm. So this is wonderful that this student population is also helping creating a curriculum that is stronger in telling histories that are more complete.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty, talking to Dr. Pamela Capistoro. She's the co-director of the Community Education Project at Tomoka Correctional Institute. She's with Stetson University. Going forward, are you going to be relying on more grant funding, or do you think there could be funding from other sources? Like, could the state of Florida itself start putting some more money into prison education?
These five programs that we currently have in the state, they have different models, and the economic support is coming from different parts, right? So we mm-hmm. hope that that we will engage in conversations also with the Secretary of the Department of Correction, Mark Inch, to see how we can all...
What's been the response from your fellow professors and others involved in the program? Are they pleased with the way things are going?
Yes, they're very, very pleased. Currently, we have had in the program more than 35 faculty members from Stetson University participating, and there is a lot of very, very good energy. During the summer, we are going to have Dr. Sarah Kramer teaching a food studies course. So, of course, there's a lot of interest, a lot of people that are supporting us, and the president of the university, Wendy Levy, Provost Noel Painter. So there's a lot of good energy mm-hmm. From Seton community.
Do other people want in on the program now?
Well, yes, and not only faculty members, but also students. We have sets of interns, Stephanie Arenas, Mira Sad, and Matt Brogan. So it's not only professors, it's also coming from the students.
And what are you hearing from the folks who are at the prison and enrolled in the course? What kind of feedback are you getting from them?
Yes, it's been wonderful, especially with this last year of funding from the Laughing Gull Foundation, having the computer lab, having more contact hours in the prison. This has been very transformative for how we started and how the program and where the program is going through mm-hmm. and the future of the program as well. So it's been very positive feedback from the students.
Is there a waiting list to get into the program?
The answer is yes. We are going to be recruiting more students for this upcoming fall semester. And as you know, right, one of the things that we will be trying to address in the gathering is that how we can expand the opportunities across Florida prisons, because there's 100,000 people currently incarcerated, and we are programs that unfortunately we cannot offer to and reach out to all mm-hmm. the population. So we hope that with the gathering, the conversations that we wanted to start collectively, we can start to answer these questions.
Are there some prisons that you have in mind where you're like, this prison would be a prime candidate for an education program like the one we have at Tomoka? Can you personally think of some places where you could definitely replicate what you've done and take that elsewhere in the state of Florida?
One of the very underserved populations that I'm always thinking is the women prisons. Mm-hmm. So I really hope that that with more support we can have a program that maybe is similar to what we're doing or similar to what other people are doing in the state as well, because I think that we will also learn from what is functioning and what is good from other programs, so we can adapt that to our current model of CEP. And hopefully that could be replicated in other parts of the states, but especially in the women's prison.
Why is it that women's prisons are particularly underserved?
To be honest with you, it could be a matter of distance. A lot of the universities are very, very far away from any prison, right? But from mm-hmm. women's prison, it could be that. It could be many things, and this is something that is not happening only at the state level, but also at the national level, that when we think about women's prisons, they tend to be very, very far away. They're underserved.
Now, speaking about the national level, has there been some national interest in the program that you're running through Stetson University?
Yes, actually, the model and the direction in which we are going and all the support that we have been getting is thanks to the national platform. 3 years ago, I was serving at the Strategic Planning Committee to create the Alliance for Higher Education in Prison. So in that meeting, I got the opportunity to meet with other program directors from very successful programs from California, from the Education Justice Project of Illinois, where I come from originally, from New York. So all of these people that were working together in a room to try to build the alliance gave me very, very important feedback, but also they helped me to think about funding for the project, but also how to prepare in order to become a strong, sustainable project.
Is that mm-hmm. the biggest challenge, funding?
I will think so. I mean, there's many, many challenges, right, as you mm-hmm. might think, because you're working with two constituencies, the university, the Department of Correction.
That's a lot of bureaucracy to get through.
Indeed, but definitely having people that have been doing this for a long time and doing it well, I mm-hmm. think it helps a lot. Having their support, it's very, very helpful.
It seems like you've got a real sense of mission. Is that the way you feel about this project?
Yeah, definitely. This is a long-term investment. This is not a passion project. This is something that we started 5 years ago at Stetson, and we envisioned this to be a long-term investment, educational investment mm-hmm. In terms of like the personal, but also the societal investment. We want for the public to understand the importance of providing access to higher education to incarcerated individuals.
And to get that message across to the public, is it a matter of just having the folks who've gone through the program, the prisoners themselves, tell their stories?
I think it's a matter of everyone that is involved in the project. It's people that are incarcerated to hearing their voices through the research that they're doing, right? So people can see that the people that are incarcerated, they do have a lot of intellectual contributions to offer to the society. It's a matter of policymakers, about directors, right? Like it's about everybody that is involved in the process of being student, being professors, involved in higher education in prison programs to start the conversation. But definitely incarcerated individuals must have a voice in this conversation.
Dr. Pamela Capistoro is the co-director of the education program at Tomoka Correctional Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come, healing the psychological trauma of hurricanes. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. After Hurricane Maria, many survivors left Puerto Rico to make a new life in Florida. One community in Orlando especially, Azalea Park, embraced the new arrivals, and activists are now stepping up efforts to help hurricane survivors deal with the psychological trauma of the storm. UCF Restores, a clinic that treats veterans and first responders for PTSD, is setting up a satellite clinic at Jesus of Nazareth Episcopal Church in Azalea Park, offering treatment to storm survivors. Therapists will start their work there this Thursday. The director of UCF Restores is Dr. Deborah Beidle. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us here.
Also joined by Father Jose Rodriguez, the vicar of the Episcopal Church of Jesus of Nazareth in Azalea Park. Thank you so much, Father Jose.
Thank you very much for having us.
So, Deborah, you've been working with UCF Restores for some time now, and a lot of what you've done has been focused on helping veterans cope with PTSD. Tell me about this new iteration of the program.
Well, the new iteration of the program is that we have actually branched out to work with people with many different types of trauma. And so certainly being in a level 5 hurricane and then losing your home and having to relocate to Central Florida is a traumatic event for people. And so we're proud to be able to help people recover from trauma.
Mm-hmm. And how are you going to do that?
We are hiring 3 culturally competent Spanish-speaking therapists. And what I mean by that is people who understand the culture of Puerto Rico and who are able to do therapy in Spanish. This is not something we've had the ability to do before. So we're going to be offering mental health services to both adults and children who have been affected by Hurricane Maria and also Hurricane Irma.
Mm-hmm.
We are also going to be establishing a web-based training program to train people such as clergy and school teachers who might be the first contact with school children, helping them learn to recognize the signs of trauma.
Father Jose, what about your role in helping get this program up and running?
Well, our role is that we are a church in the community that received a lot of Puerto Ricans after the hurricane. We're a few minutes, 15 minutes from the airport. It's an area that traditionally has received a lot of migration recently from Puerto Rico, and UCF approached us and started this great relationship and partnership to serve a population that we're already serving,
mm-hmm.
the Latino community. They often seek out priests and pastors and their local churches in order to get services.
When you started seeing people coming over from Puerto Rico because their homes had been devastated by Hurricane Maria, were you prepared for that?
We were prepared for people to come, but not the volume of individuals that have come.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, after disaster, I get an uptake in pastoral counseling sessions, but we've really had an overwhelming response. We first saw it in our food pantry, and then my phone ringing off the hook, text messages of people just want to come in and talk to somebody. I can talk to someone initially, but the ongoing care, that really is beyond my ability to help someone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where someone like UCF Restores comes in. They really have the competency to help people deal with trauma.
So you've got 2 things kind of going on at the same time. You're helping practically you mentioned the food pantry. I'm sure there's other things you've been helping out with as well. And then there's the psychological, spiritual impact of a devastating hurricane like Maria.
Yeah, it all kind of goes hand in hand, the spiritual aspect and the physical needs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really hard to say, hey, come here for the food, but go somewhere else for mental health care. The reality is, in this community, people want to go to the church and have all their needs taken care of.
Now, Deborah Beidle mentioned that one of the things they're doing is trying to find people who are culturally competent. Are you sort of helping steer that as well?
Yeah, that's actually the cultural competency bit is the most important part. The Puerto Rican community itself isn't monolithic. The Latino community is not monolithic. So identifying individuals that know the migration story, the migration experience, and can speak to it. Not only that, but they've experienced hurricanes themselves, and they know the fear of, those triggers that get you after you've survived a hurricane, thunder, rain, or even just seeing a house with a tarp on it triggers some people.
Mm-hmm.
So having someone that knows the language, has the experience, but also has lived through migration is very important. This is someone who's lived the life, they've experienced it, and they can really tell someone, I know what you're going through because I've been through this as well.
Deborah, how different is it working with people who've experienced this kind of trauma as opposed to people who've gone through a wartime situation? Like, what sort of different skills do you need to bring to bear in the work that you do?
Well, I think you need the understanding of exactly what has happened to them, because in many cases, the people we're going to see are actually having 2 traumas, if you really think about it. First is the loss of their home, and then it's moving to a neighborhood or a community or even the mainland that's very much different. So there's different practices here, different cultures, different languages. So in a way, that's a second sort of event that might bring trauma. The other thing is we know that for many people, it's not just post-traumatic stress disorder or even post-traumatic stress disorder. It could be just depression may be very much involved with this. It could be general anxiety that's involved with this. So to think more broadly about the effects of trauma than just post-traumatic stress disorder.
Are you kind of writing the guidebook for how to do this as you go along?
Well, we have some ideas about how to do it, but certainly we're going to listen to the people who come to us and provide them the services that we think they might need. And that's why, again, we're not just going in there with one specific treatment and saying, okay, here's what you're going to get. We're going to listen to what the needs are, and then we're going to provide those needs. We think they will be very much similar, but we're not sure that they'll be identical.
So walk me through what happens once you've identified folks who need help. Is it like a course of sessions? Is there like a set amount of sessions that you do, or do you have to tailor it to each individual?
It'll be tailored to each individual. Right now we have funding through SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration in Washington. We have money for 1 year. We hope that if, you know, there will be continuing need, that we will be able to get more funding. But people will come in and they will tell us how they're feeling. And we'll make decisions that such as, oh, you need some treatment for depression, or you need some treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And then maybe you need more treatment for depression. Maybe you need marital counseling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe this has created stress between husband and wife. And therefore, then we have to think about doing marital counseling instead. We also think we're going to see people who might need some more basic needs. And although that's not necessarily part of mental health counseling, if you don't have any money to buy food or to put shelter, that's going to be a stressor that we're going to have to deal with in some way.
Do you have funding to deal with that, or do you have to reach out to other organizations for that?
We'll reach out to organizations, but we'll also hopefully help people find the right organization. So we won't just say, here's a whole bunch of numbers, give them a call.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll help make sure that they make that correct connection.
Father Jose, is that where you and other faith leaders might come in and sort of help make those connections for people? I mean, as Deborah says, it's not going to be enough to just give somebody a phone number and say, you're on your own now.
That is exactly where we come in. For the past 16 months, we've already been in Hurricane Maria recovery. We have the food pantry. We offer clothing. We offer community referrals, but we do a lot of the work in-house. We raise our own money so we can help the individuals that come. So this is where we work hand-in-hand with them.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing she mentioned that's really important is they listen. That's what's really important about our partnership with academia. We've discovered over the past 16 months that our academic partners, UCF, they're the best suited to listen, adapt, and change, because that's the versatility they bring to the table. They do research. They care for people. They provide assistance. But that research background, that listening background, really attunes them to respond appropriately.
What's this been like for you? Has it taken a bit of a toll on yourself?
It's been challenging for me, my church, our volunteers. Like I said, we've all experienced migration ourselves. My family came to Azalea Park in the early 80s. So I remember my go-around going to get assistance in the community as a child, learning English, being helped by churches, and seeing it happen all over again in the life of others has been both inspiring, because I get to bring something to the table. Not only am I a person of faith, but I'm a person that's experienced this. But it also reminds me that a lot of the struggles that we faced when I was young are still being faced by people 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really glad that organizations like UCF Restores have stepped up to say, we're going to make it different this time.
So what kind of help was there for people 30 years ago?
There wasn't as much as is being offered now. There definitely wasn't someone who will sit down with you and talk about your trauma.
Mm-hmm.
The food pantries were further away. I remember that we had to go 20, 30 minutes across town for a food pantry, versus now we have the food pantries in the neighborhood. And then there wasn't that cultural competency bit. They used to be, you get what we give you, how we give it to you, without any care as to speaking to someone in their language and making them feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we value our relationship with UCF, because they get it. They get that you meet people where they are, and you don't kind of have this colonial mindset where you force them to change to fit your mold, but you meet them where they are. And for us as a church, it's very incarnational. To us, that's what Jesus would do.
Meeting people where they are has actually two specific meanings. One is meeting them emotionally where they are. But in this project, we're actually going to be situated in the church. So Father Jose has graciously given us space within the church that we will have a private entrance and a private room. So we're not expecting people to have to come all the way over to UCF to get the services. We're actually going to be going to them.
Some of the stuff you do as part of your work, or you've done as part of your work with veterans, has been fairly high tech, right? It's been kind of immersive. You've used a little bit of VR. Are you going to bring some of that technology to bear for this as well?
If we have it available, there are some VR technologies that would allow us to simulate parts of a hurricane. But we can also, we don't need the big fancy head-mounted displays, the goggles. We can use sounds of a hurricane. We can use different smells. So we will do what we need to do to help people get over the fears that they have.
And you can do all of this in the church?
As long as we don't have to bring the big head-mounted display and all of the equipment. You can get sounds off of YouTube that will do the same thing, and we'll be able to simulate some of that. Sometimes just sitting in the dark. A lot of the kids are afraid of the dark, so just have them sit in the dark. You know, we just turn the lights off. It's low-tech, but it's what works.
Father Jose, I'm wondering, too, if there's a difference in attitude among the folks coming over, like, 30 years ago, would people have been as willing to ask for help?
I think, generally speaking, in the Latino community, people are resistant to ask for help. Very resilient, very proud people. They work for everything they have. And it's not been an issue of them wanting help. For us, it's the issue of us offering the help and letting them know it's available and saying there's no shame in getting this help. And that's part of the cultural competency as well. What that UCF brings to the table. We know that it's not going to be as easy as opening up our doors and saying, come and get help, but we're going to have outreach through the church to let people know UCF is here. There's no shame in coming. Come and talk, and we want to help you through this trauma. We want to help you be the best person you can be in your new community.
What is that outreach going to look like?
Right now, we have some caseworkers. We're raising money to keep them on staff. Our caseworkers are Hurricane Maria survivors, so we kind of consider them like peer mentors. They've been through it. They've gotten the apartments, they've settled in, and then they're going to be the ones, they're known to the community, and they're going to be the ones that are going to be working the phones. They're going to be going to events and saying, hi, I'm a Hurricane Maria survivor like you. The one thing they have in common is the date they arrived. That's how they greet each other. Hi, I arrived on this date, and oh, I arrived on this date. It's like their icebreaker. So that's that second cultural piece we're bringing in. Not only someone that's migrated, not only someone who speaks Spanish and Puerto Rican, but someone who has survived that very same disaster. And we hope to send them out to community events, work the phones. We have our own lists of names and numbers. And then as people walk into the church for food and other items, say, hey, we have this as well. You should consider being part of this.
Has it been a bit of a tax on resources for the church and for other folks who are doing the work in the community? Like, how do you go about raising money to stock the food pantry, to, you know, give people the resources they need?
I ran out of money 3 months ago, but through God's grace, we've made it week by week. My own caseworkers, we ran out of money for them quite a while ago.
But so how are you surviving?
I've been hustling the streets begging for money, to be honest.
And is there somewhere people can go if they want to donate?
They can contact the church, and we'd gladly take whatever resources they'd like to give to keep our payroll going. Because sadly, you just can't do this on your own. I mean, we need to have people working this project. UCF has been very generous in bringing those three mental health providers. The church just needs a little bit of assistance to keep our own staffing going. Azalea Park has the only Title I school that's majority Hispanic in the district. And that really gives you a flavor to the challenges that are in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You have Colonial High School, it's a Title I high school, and then all the feeder schools that are also Title I schools. So there's a unique set of challenges at Azalea Park that UCF Restores is going to help bring hope to. Their presence in that community is very needed, especially for those schools that have taken in children from Maria. It's going to impact the community from the educational level up.
Mm-hmm. I want to know more about Azalea Park, too. I mean, it sounds like a very unique community within Orlando and a community that's obviously seen a lot of change over the last 3 or 4 decades.
Yeah, if you think of the intersection, that's Cimarron and Lake Underhill, where the 408 is, straight shot to the airport. If you're coming off the 408, you can either take the 408 to the B-line and get off at the airport, or sometimes you just get off at that intersection. It is really close to downtown Orlando. It is an area that when my family first moved in the 80s was populated heavily by the Cuban community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just seen successive wave after successive wave of different Hispanic groups. And it's pretty much settled in as an enclave of Puerto Ricans. The intersections between Cimarron, Lake Underhill and Cimarron and 50, really, you go in there, the billboards are in Spanish. You have all the little Puerto Rican bodegas. There used to be 5 or 6 Cuban restaurants in a Cuban bodega there, but now they're all Puerto Rican bodegas and restaurants and whatnot. It is a little piece of San Juan in Orlando.
Which is your favorite restaurant?
My favorite restaurant there? That's still the Cuban one, actually. Cubanao. That's over in Azalea Park.
What's the best thing on the menu?
I have ropa vieja. That's my favorite thing.
What about getting out and sort of bringing the work that you do out into the community, whether it's at Father Jose's church or maybe other places? Is this the first time you've kind of gone off site with this?
This is the first time since I've been in Florida that we've gone off site on this, and we're very happy to do it. So it's challenging. We have to think about things like, you know, making sure we have laptops and Wi-Fi and internet connections so people can, you know, take advantage of what they need to online. We have to think about things like HIPAA privacy and protection. So we're working with Father Jose on doing all that. It's not impossible. It's just a matter of therapists thinking of out of the box. I mean, in our exposure therapy, part of our exposure therapy is taking people where there are crowds. So our therapists often are outside of their clinic when they're doing therapy. But this is the first time that we've actually completely set up at another place.
It must feel satisfying, though, to have this is a measure of success, that the program is growing, there are more people seeing the value in what you're doing and reaching out and making these connections?
Absolutely. I mean, our commitment has always been to be part of the community of Greater Orlando, and this is one way that we can do that in partnership.
You've done a lot with victims of trauma in the last few years. I mean, it seems like Orlando has seen it maybe more than its fair share of trauma, right? Mm-hmm. So in some ways, you're ideally positioned to help out this community, this city.
I think we are. We wanted to step forward and do this because we felt we were in a unique position between our work with veterans and our work with first responders and then our work with the survivors of the Pulse nightclub shooting. We feel like we've learned a lot in the community and what the community needs. And so when we were asked, hey, do you know of any needs, mental health needs that Hurricane Maria, you know, people who've come over from Puerto Rico might have? We're like, yes, yes, yes. Here's what we need. And here's what we're going to do.
I imagine word of mouth is going to help get the word out as well. Father Jose, like once some people go through this, they'll see the value and then tell folks that they know who need help as well.
Most definitely. In the past year and a half, we've had a healthy offering of services at the church. It's all been word of mouth and a little bit of Facebook. So we know that once the first two or three patients roll in, the doors will be open and serving a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So what's your message to people who may benefit from this, may need some help, or people who want to learn a little more about what's going on at the church?
My message to anyone that needs help is hope comes in many forms. And an important form that hope is communicated is by sitting with a sympathetic ear, someone who's trained to listen and offer feedback and coping skills. Our community typically resists this kind of help. And what we're seeing is there's no shame in coming out and talking to somebody, being listened to, and being taken care of. At the church, our doors are open to anyone. This is open to anyone. You don't have to be a Christian. You don't have to be Episcopalian. I don't really care. Whoever you are, if you're in need, please come and we will welcome you and we will provide you the full services that are available.
We say that it takes courage to face your fears. And so we think this is a wonderful opportunity and that there are ways to get over your fears, that you don't have to live the rest of your life as a victim of your fears and your post-traumatic stress disorder. You can take control of it. You can take back your life. And that's the goal at UCF Restores. That's what Restores means. We're restoring lives, families, and communities.
Well, Deborah Beidle is the director of UCF Restores. We've been talking about the new program to help survivors of Hurricane Maria. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us here.
Father Jose Rodriguez is the vicar of the Episcopal Church of Jesus of Nazareth in Azalea Park. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.